Till says. Just now, with the Commissar, leaving that place you go to. She asked it of you, didn't she? Gave you another duty to do, and you picked her over us. Shut up, Cass, he says. That's where you go, on those nights we don't fight. Till's face twists in an ugly way. What is it, Captain? A midnight dance? Shut your damn mouth, he shouts at her. She punches him then, square in the face. Fell's vision dazzles for a second, and he tastes blood. His temper breaks like kindling, and he grabs hold of Till by the front of her fatigues and puts her up against the wall. Enough, he says. Till stops fighting him, and looks at him, stunned. Throne of Earth, Till murmurs, in Antari now. You love her, don't you? I can see it in your face. Fell lets Till go and takes a step back from her. Leave it alone, he says, though he knows that it's too late for that. You do? Till sounds dumbfounded. You damned fool. She is a Commissar, Dren. Till only calls him by the shorthand of his name when she really wants to talk to him and not her captain, when they are being kin and not just soldiers. I know that, Fell says. Believe me. It'll be the death of you, one way or another, Till says. Those words settle heavy on Fell, because he can't deny them. I know that too, he says, but I trust her. Severina might be a Commissar, and an outsider, but she is much more than the sum of those things. She's a fierce heart, Cass. Till shakes her head at his use of Rain's given name, but all of the fight has gone out of her. I don't doubt it, she says, but it doesn't make you any less of a fool. Fell shakes his head. You might be right about that, he says. Till puts her hand out, and the two of them clasp wrists. It's a gesture of forgiveness. Nobody else learns of this, Fell says. I want your word. You have it, Till says. And just to be clear, Fell says, you never take a swing at me like that again. Is that understood? Till's face colours, and she holds up her hands. Understood, Captain, she says. Now tell me about Maya, Fell says. I want to know how it happened. Till looks down the corridor, as if she is worried that she will be heard. Fell is reminded of the picked feed capture of Isabella Luz. It was Roll, she says softly. I know it sounds like dream talk, but I swear it to you. It isn't. Fell is already hurting from everything he has seen and heard today, and from everything he now knows. But there is still plenty of room for another hurt, as Till tells him about finding Roll again in the Sanctum of Bones. About everything he said to her. Everything he did. She gets so far through the retelling and just stops. Her hand goes to her side, where there is a good deal of blood staining her fatigues. You had to kill him, Fell says. Yes, Till says quietly. Fell can't help thinking of when he recruited the two of them. Roll and Till had come up from the Skolem as a pair, and stayed that way in every fight after, like shadows for one another. As good as blood. I'm sorry, Cass, he says softly. Till shakes her head. Me too, she says. She takes a deep breath and shakes her head as if to clear it. I can't understand it, Captain. It truly was him. Not a ghost, nor an illusion. It wasn't glamour or a mask. It was Roll. But he had given up everything. How can that be? Fell shakes his head. I can't explain it, he says. And it is the truth. He wouldn't know where to begin. But he is not the first, and he won't be the last. Till frowns. What are you saying? I'm saying that things are going to get worse, and that our enemies won't always be easy to see or face. I know that you think I am a fool, But I mean it when I say I trust the Commissar, and you should too. I swear to you that I will explain everything, but I can't yet. Not until I know it is safe to do so. Captain, Till begins. What? I can't, Fell says. But he makes a quick motion with his hands, in the battle sign that only the Duskhounds use. Enemies, it means. Surrounded. Till's eyes turn wary. She nods her head slowly. Understood, she says. Fell realizes there is something amiss the moment he enters his quarters and the automated lumens flicker on. He draws his pistol on instinct and scans the room. His carapace armor and his weapons are still secured by genetic lock. His kit bag is stowed, and the hand-bound book of litanies is sitting where he left it on the thin mattress. The blanket is folded neatly and undisturbed. There are no boot prints, save his own. It's the table that's different. Or more precisely, the two tin cups he left on it. They are the ones he uses for making windfall tea and reading the leaves. The ones he takes with him when he goes to see rain. One of them has fallen onto the floor. Fell treads lightly as he crosses the room to where the tin cup is rolling on its curved edge, catching in the draught that blows through the gaps in the mortar of the walls. He nudges at the cup with the toe of his boot, and it rolls a little more, but nothing else happens. Fell exhales a long breath, then shakes his head. It's the day, he thinks, making him paranoid. He holsters the pistol, then stoops down and picks up the cup. It is the one that he gives to Rain. He scored a pattern of thorns into the rim of it, because you should always read from the same one so that the fates don't get tangled. Rain laughed when he first explained it to her, but now she understands, and she listens. Sometimes she even lets him tell her what he sees in her fate. Fell has never tried to hide from Rain what he feels. There would be no point, even if he wanted to, because she would see right through him, as she does with everything. But they have never acted on it, no matter what Till might think. Fell has no doubt that he means something to the Commissar, but she is a Commissar, and he is a soldier. And that means something too. Fell goes to put the cup back down on the table, and realizes there is something else amiss. Something that doesn't belong, and it makes him flinch to see it. It is a twist of metal, with a red glass lens set into it, and silver cables coiled up like insects' legs. It's only when he puts his hand out and takes hold of it that he realizes what it is. An augmetic lens. Laurie Gale's augmetic lens.
Curse! Fell shouts, and it's all he gets to do, because as soon as the lens breaks contact with the metal of the table, he hears a familiar sound. A charge triggering. There's a deafening roar and a flash of light and a huge pressure wave. The room turns around him, and he ends up on the floor on the other side of it, by the door, struggling to breathe, struggling to see. Fell tries to get to his feet, but only makes it halfway before falling again. He puts his right hand out to catch himself, only to find that it is gone, and most of his arm with it. It is just blood and bone. Jagged shards of shrapnel have buried themselves in his chest and his stomach. He is bleeding badly, really badly, all over the floor. Hells, Fell manages to say, and it uses up the last of the air in his lungs. He hears Till shouting something over the ringing in his ears, and sees her move into his narrowing vision as it washes in shades of grey. He wants to tell her to get clear in case there's another charge, but he can't get the words together. Can't see her clearly. Till's words become a rush and a mumble, until he can't hear them at all. The world disappears, and leaves him in darkness, just like those isolation chambers. Shapes in the shadows. On the edge, with his heart going arrhythmic, and the rest of him going numb. Fell hears a different voice. Rain's voice. Until the end, she says. Chapter 17. Consequences. The Medicaid facility used to be the Skolem's own hospital ward. It is all tiles and steel, and it catches the echoes of machine noise and of the wounded. Catches the echo of Rain's boots on the tiles as she pushes her way through to where they have taken Andrin Fell. All of that noise is a rush and a roar, like the ocean, like the explosion. She had heard it, even from the other wing, felt the tremor through the stone. Rain's hands are already fists, but now she curls them so tightly that her knuckles ache with it. Neri Alai sees her coming. The medic is standing beside the curtained-off bays. Her scrubs are blood-soaked, and there is some in her hairline, too. She opens her mouth to speak, but Rain doesn't give her chance. "Does he live?" she asks. Lai nods. "Just," she says. "It is bad, Commissar." Rain knew it would be, but that doesn't make it easy to hear. "Let me see him," she says. "See how bad it is." Lai runs a hand through her hair and sighs. "Yes, sir," she says. Lai takes her over to one of the bays. "He's in and out," she says, "on a good deal of meds. He won't be able to tell you much, if anything, and I beg you not to press him." Rain nods. On the face of it, she is there in her capacity as Commissar, to find out what happened and punish those responsible. That's what Lai sees, because that's what Rain lets her see. But Rain knows where she can lay the blame for this, and so much else. The visit is because she cares, and Rain realizes exactly how much when Lai pulls the curtain back. Andrin Fell is cut, as if by a dozen blades. Shallow wounds mark his face and throat, and there are dark circles of blood on the bandages around his chest from much deeper ones. He is stuck with intravenous needles for pain medication, blood and fluids. "He was full of shrapnel," Lai says in a low voice. "He is lucky he made it here. The amount he bled." Rain is only half listening. She is looking at where they have had to cut away Fell's right arm, almost to the shoulder. Rain takes a breath and smells counterseptic. "Leave," she says to Lai. The medic does as she is told immediately. Rain's voice allows for nothing else. The curtain behind her falls closed again. Rain waits for Lai's boots to recede before she approaches him, before she speaks. "Andrin," she says. He stirs, just barely, but he doesn't wake or answer her. Rain wants to say his name again. She wants to shake him just so that he'll wake and speak to her because she can't stand how still he is. "I warned you," she says, "but you wouldn't walk away. You had to be so honorable." She shakes her head. "I wish you had walked away," she says.
"Not dead yet."
Fell's words stun Rain. His voice doesn't sound like his own, and when he opens his eyes, they are glassy. His pupils are like pinpricks in the grey. "No," Rain says softly. "Not yet." She moves closer, close enough to reach out and touch him. "What happened?" she asks him. He frowns, and she sees the fingers on his good hand curl.
"I can't remember," he says. "Not a thing. But fire."
His words are halting. Rain can see how it hurts him to talk. "It's all right," she says. And her words are halting too, a different kind of hurt. "I will hunt down the ones who did this. This and everything else. I will break every last one of them." Fell nods.
"I know," he says. "I know you will."
Rain looks at the mess that is left of his arm and listens to the rattle of his chest as he breathes.
"Andrin," she says, "I am sorry."
He shakes his head.
"Until the end," he says. "I swore it."
"I know," Rain says, "but it is too much to give."
"No," Fell says. "It isn't. Not for you."
Rain shakes her head, because he's wrong. It is too much to give. and it is too much for her to take too, because despite how hard she has tried to keep her heart her own, she has failed. She has allowed herself to care, to trust, to love him. Rain takes hold of his good hand and laces her fingers in his. She means to say it then, to tell him exactly what he means to her. But his grey eyes have closed, and he is still and silent again, save for his breathing. "Rest easy, Andrenfell," Rain says, though she knows he cannot hear her. "I still have stories I owe you." Till has washed her hands with boiled water, scrubbed them until the skin is red, but she still can't get rid of the blood under her fingernails. Her captain's blood. Till looks up from her hands at the sound of footsteps as Rain emerges from the curtained medical bay. The Commissar's face is set in the same way it always is, giving away nothing. Her eyes, though, are an altogether different story. They are full of pain and rage. Till feels guilt then, at her earlier words, and the way she scorned Fel for giving up his heart.
"Commissar," Till says, before she can change her mind. "A word?"
"Of course," Rain says.
The rage is there in her voice, too, running underneath it like water under ice, and just as cold. The two of them walk together out of the Medicaid facility and into the Skolem proper, to the outside, where the wind carries their words away.
"The rumour mill says that the site had infiltrated this place," Till says, looking at the posted guards and the gun nests, the Valkyrie gunships, crouched on the yard like hawks over prey. "That they were the ones to plant that device."
"And what do you think?" Rain asks. Those furious eyes of hers bore into Till. It feels as though she can see right through to her soul. Till makes an effort to hold Rain's gaze.
"I think that if the Sighted were to infiltrate this place, they would have burned the lot to the ground and cut us to ribbons. I think that this was something else, something personal."
She pauses and considers her next words carefully.
"I think that it was done to get to you," Till says.
Rain's face doesn't change.
"The captain wouldn't tell me what is going on," Till says. "He said it wasn't safe to."
She huffs a humorless laugh.
"But he did tell me that enemies surround us. And he told me that I should trust you."
Till holds out her hand, palm down to the ground, the way she does when the Duskhounds make their oaths.
"So, this is me trusting you," she says. "This is me swearing what's left of the Duskhounds to you anew, on the understanding that we will bleed whoever did this to my captain."
Finally, there is a change in Rain's face, and Till sees a glimpse of that heart of hers, fierce, like the captain said. Rain puts her hand on top of Till's.
"We will bleed them," Rain says. "I swear it."
It is falling dark again when Wick makes his way down to the tanker's lot. Like last time, it is noisy with the songs of repair and reconsecration. This time, the damage is much worse, though. Every one of the fire giants he walks past is blackened and broken, and there is a space in the line where Mountain Song would rest if she weren't dead. He finds Colat with Stone King at the end of the line, like always. He's not on his own this time. There's another of the crew with him, that idiot who is bigger even than Chris. The two of them are stood up on the demolisher, talking. Stone King is torn open all across her chassis and her turret.
"Hey, Eli,"
the idiot says when he sees Wick.
"I think we've a lost one here. Are you lost, infantry?"
Colat turns and looks. His goggles are pushed up on his head, so Wick can see the way his eyes go wide, even with the half-dark and the distance. There's not a hint of that steel smile of his. The whole thing is almost worth it, then, just for that look.
"Get out of here, Curry," Colat says.
The big idiot shrugs and drops down off the tank. He passes by Wick with the intent of shouldering him as he goes. Wick sidesteps it, and Curie nearly loses his footing in the mud.
Careful there, Armour, Wick says. You spend enough time sitting on your ass as it is.
Curie scowls and squares up to him.
I told you to go, Colette says as he drops into the mud. Don't make me say it again.
Curie clearly knows Colette well enough to know not to argue. He shrugs again with that scowl still on his face. Then he walks away up the line. Wick looks at Colette standing there. He's got a thick-headed hammer in one hand.
What are you doing here, Wick? Colette snarls.
What am I doing here? Wick says.
That's not really what you're asking, is it?
What you're really asking is why I'm still living, despite your best efforts. Despite you ratting me out to my own.
Colette raises that hammer of his a little in answer, and Wick shakes his head.
You aren't going to brain me with that, he says. Not here, where everyone can see. Not unless you're as stupid as your crewmate. Oh, I didn't come here for a fight.
You, Colette says, not here for a fight? Why does that sound like a lie?
Wick laughs, because Colette has never been able to tell when he lies.
Either you put that hammer down and we talk, or I'll rat you out, like you did to me. I'll tell the Commissar all about what you did to Edra. And you can see if you walk away from her.
Colette blinks and glances up the line where the others are all working. Then he curses in his Southlander dialect and drops the hammer in the dirt. The head of it buries itself in the mud.
Talk, he says.
Good call, Wick says. Here's the thing. You tried to get me killed, Eli, and that sits very poorly with me.
Colette shakes his head. You're the one who did the killing, and of the dead in the water. I just reported what I saw. It comes back to Wick in flashes then. The rain, the cold, the smell of the dark, still water, the euphoria at surviving a fight that blackens and rots and turns to guilt and anger. There was a time he'd just push all that away, let it sink like the bodies. It's not been so easy lately. Not since the forgers and the pendant he took. Not since the look Jay gave him in the sanctum. The same look Chris gave him when they took him away in chains. He was in the right when he made those kills, but he didn't do it because it was right. Not really. He did it out of instinct. Out of the need to hurt and be hurt. He did it because he is splintered, like Ord said. Snapped.
That's true, Wick says. But you still sold me out. Not only that, you tried to turn my own against me. That knocks the scales out. It means you owe me.
Colette's shoulders slump a little. Whatever else he is Antari, and he knows the value of an owing.
So report me, he says bitterly. Like you said before, make it even.
Wick shakes his head. That bolt shell he carries is heavy, like walking into water with a pocketful of stones.
No, he says. Even would be me telling your crew. The big idiot Curie, Verne, and Lieutenant Frayne, with her holy soul. There are many things I'll do, but not that.
What then? Colette asks.
Wick thinks about the next ugly fight, about enemies all around them, and the jaws of death opening wide and dark.
I want more stims, he says. As strong as you can come by. I want them every time I ask for them, with no thought of payment or owing. Until I'm not here to ask any more.
Colette scowls.
Fine, he says. No payment or owing, for as long as you're here. You have my word.
Good, Wick says.
He turns to go then, but he stops and looks back before he does.
Oh. There's something else, he says.
What?
Colette asks, glaring at him.
If you try to come after me ever again, I'll tell Zane that you were the one to rat us out.
Colette's eyes go wide again.
You wouldn't give me up to a cursling like her, he says. To a witch!
I would, Wick says. In a heartbeat.
Colette spits on the ground. You're a bastard. Do you know that?
Wick nods. So everyone keeps telling me.
Chapter 18. Bale's Heart. Rain watches through the armor glass as the surface of Laxus Secundus falls away beneath the bulk lander. The City of Defiance and the war-broken land around it become distant enough to look like a spreading stain. And then the lander breaks the cloud layer, and she loses sight of it altogether.
The rest of the regiment are underway, Commissar.
The voice belongs to Yuri Hale. Like her, the captain is also wearing a dress uniform. His is solid grey, save for a sash and beret in forest green. The icon of the rifles pinned to Hale's beret is made from painted enamel, and not from gold or brass. You look ill at ease, Rain says. Hale's smile is wry.
It's the ceremony of it, he says.
Rain turns and looks out to the clouds. They are thinning and breaking as the lander leaves the poison sky of Laxus Secundus behind. It is the accepted protocol, she says, when attending a strategium called by the Lord General Militant. The summons had come shortly after Rain's visit to see Fel in the infirmary, and it had been unequivocal. The entire regiment were to pull out of Defiance immediately and report to Fleet Command for their next deployment. Rain remembers the closing line, stamped in red ink. By order of the Lord General Militant Alar Serek. For the Bale Stars. For the Emperor. It is an effort for Rain not to drive her fist into the armor glass of the viewport.
Perhaps it is protocol, but it seems needless to me,
Hale says. Formality always does to the Antari, because their own ceremonies are an equalizer, not a show of power. And Rain knows that is exactly what the call to the strategium is. It is Serek, showing them just how powerful he is. The strategium hall on board the Retribution-class warship Bale's Heart is a monstrosity built from steel and gold. Banners hang from the vaulted ceiling, rippling in the recycled air. The gold thread catches in the starlight from the arched viewports. Baroque, detailed murals span the walls, wrought in paint and plaster and gilding. Rain sees Steadfast and Paxar, Hicks and Virtue, and dozens of other battlefields. She might have been proud to see it once, to stand in this hall and look upon the Crusade's many victories. But now, no matter where Rain looks, she sees only lies.
I have never seen a gathering like it, Hale says.
If he was ill at ease before, Hale now looks entirely discomforted. Rain sees the same look on the faces of every one of the four Antari captains sent to represent the regiment.
Not since Steadfast, Juna Keen says.
Like her captains, the Antari general is in dress greys, her rank marked by the white cuffs and lapels. She waits with her arms folded across her chest. Keen has been general since the day Rain joined the regiment. She is tough and clever. A good commander.
You were there? At the reconsecration? Rain asks.
Keen nods.
I was not tithed long then, of course, she says. But I saw it.
Saw the Lord General Militant confer the first of his lion's honours.
Saw them collapse the last bastion.
She pauses, and a smile flickers on her scarred face.
When the dust rolled out from it, we all put our hands into it and marked ourselves.
She unfolds her arms, then draws one hand across her chest, shoulder to hip.
Here to here, she says. That was our own honour, to be marked as he was.
Rain looks at the awe written in Juna Keen's eyes, the awe that must have been written in her own not so long ago. Another lie, just like all of the others.
There are the Cavron,
Hale says, nodding to where they are taking their places. Lucas Vander is among them, his wounded arm bandaged inside his greatcoat. He is in conversation with Caspar Sylar. The Cavron general puts a hand on Vander's shoulder, just for a moment. The gesture makes Rain wish she had left him to bleed in the Sanctum of Bones.
The Eighth Axar,
Hale continues.
Draxian Air, and the Golite Militia. The Scions of Steadfast.
House Stormfall's nobles, Devry says. The court of the High King.
Rain sees the nobles in their finery, accompanied by cherubim that scatter earth from their homeworld wherever they tread. She sees officers and commanders, generals, marshals, castellans and commissars, a hunched and robed cohort of Adeptus Mechanicus magi that vent steam and move on insectile legs. There are representatives present from every fighting force sworn to the Baelstars Crusade. The enormity of it hits Rain, then. The vastness of Serek's deceit. Because every soul in this room either serves him knowing exactly what he is, or they serve him in ignorance, as Juna Keen does. Either way, they still serve him. She is not just surrounded by victories and lies, but by enemies, too. Horns blare from the far end of the hall. Rain is reminded of the battle for the Forges. It was only days ago, but it feels like weeks, like years. Every soul in the Strategium Hall draws to attention, and Rain does so along with them. Not a single person in the Strategium Hall speaks, as the Lord General Militant walks out onto the dais, flanked by two lions of Bale in their carapace and furs, and that Castellan automaton of his. The heavy refrain of the robot's tread sounds like a dolorous heart. Serek is wearing his white dress uniform, white, like the pelt of Zane's King of Winter, with a crimson slash slung across his chest, a mark of honour and faith. Another lie.
Loyal souls of the Baelstars,
Serek's voice carries clearly over the crowd.
Today sees us take the next step on our path towards victory. Towards the restoration and sanctification of this great sector.
He looks out over the crowd. There are hundreds of people present, but Rain feels Serek's eyes fall upon her. It feels like being caught in the cold.
The shipyards of Laxus Prime are the next step, he says. They have been held by the Sighted for over a year.
There are murmured words at the mention of the Sighted, curses and prayers.
They have corrupted the shipyard cluster, Serek says, given it over to heretic machines and their masters. One of the Nine crouches at the heart of it. It names itself as Axon Foe, Fifth of Nine. It names itself that which creates.
There is a machine wail from the representative sworn to the Adeptus Mechanicus at the name, at the word creates. Their cry is static, laced with sorrow and rage. Serek waits for it to pass before he continues.
The shipyards have turned aside fleet actions and naval strike wings. They have held fast in the face of every assault. They are a jagged peak to conquer.
Every member of a regiment in the hall is looking to Serek and awaiting the order that will send them to conquer that peak. They yearn for it. Rain can see it in their unblinking eyes.
To take the shipyards will require a determination like no other, he says. A ferocity and a capacity to achieve the unachievable. It will require great sacrifice. And it will require blood.
Serek glances to the plastered, gilded walls.
Just as it did on Drast, he says, to break the unbreakable fortress of Morn. Just as it did to collapse the Sighted stronghold on Gull, to survive the Laxian Forges and the fires of Hix.
Rain keeps her eyes forwards, but she knows that around her, the Antari officers have become completely still, reverent. Serac's eyes fall upon them again, and this time Rain knows that he is looking at her. It is more than cold, that stare. It is monstrous.
The Laxian shipyards are a legend waiting to be written, Serac says. And the honor of writing it will fall to the 11th Antari Rifles.
Serac draws his sword and raises it over his head. He roars a cheer that is picked up by every soul in the Strategium Hall as they turn to face Rain and her regiment. The sound of it is deafening, baleful, like being surrounded in a storm. As one, the Antari drop to one knee and bow their heads. Rain is a heartbeat behind them, but she doesn't bow her head at all.
For the Bale Stars!
Serac shouts. Rain knows the response, as everyone in the hall does, but she has never felt the kind of rage she feels now in saying it.
For the Emperor!
Rain roars in return, her voice joining the storm. The five Antari officers are swept up and celebrated, congratulated by pilots and adepts and soldiers alike. Every soul in the room wanted that honor, and the chance to spend their blood in the Crusade's name, in Serac's name. Rain watches it happen, one step removed, as she always is. The movement of people around her, the noise, it feels like shell shock, like being the only one to see that the water has been poisoned, but unable to say a word as every person at the table drinks from their cups.
Severina Rain.
Rain looks away from her Antari at the sound of her name, to the man who speaks it. To the man dressed in white, wearing a crimson sash and carrying a gold-hilted saber at his hip. To the man whose ice-blue eyes glitter like cut gems. No, not the man. The monster.
Lord General Militant,
Rain says, and she makes the sign of the Aquila. Serac's face doesn't change. He takes a step forwards, so that he is close.
At ease,
he says, and the words seem deliberate. 5 paces back stand Serac's armed guard, his ever-present Lions of Bale and his Castellan automaton. Behind them stand the other attending representatives of High Command, sworn to serve him. Araxes, the High King of House Stormfall, Lord Castellan Caradhras, General Primary Husal of Gol. Last of all, Rain catches the mismatched eyes of Verus Drake. The Lord Marshal acknowledges her with the sparest of nods. She wears a single pin on the lapel of her crimson uniform, wrought in gold and jet. The Lion's honor. Rain has never felt less at ease, or more alone.
Strange, Serac says, that it feels such a long time since last we spoke.
Like before, it is an effort to hold Serac's stare, an effort not to take that gold-hilted saber from him and cut him down where he stands. Rain knows that she would never land the blow, that she would be shot dead by his lions and crushed by his castellan, or be torn apart by the hundreds of souls in the Strategium Hall that are sworn to him. She cannot fight him. Not here, not now. But that doesn't mean that she will back down.
Much has happened, Lord, Rain says. Much has changed.
Serac smiles then, that same arctic smile that she once wished to earn.
It is inevitable, he says. For things to endure, they must change.
As have your words, Rain says. You once told me that in order to endure, you must be a creature of faith, unbreakable.
She takes a breath.
Words I have lived by, she says. Words I have bled for and killed for.
Words are powerful, Serac says. That is what you said to me in the forges. People will die in the name of them.
He looks to where the Antari officers celebrate with the others. The hall rings with cheers and cries of devotion. Rain's heart is cold and still.
I meant what I said, Serek says. The shipyards are a legend waiting to be written. A glory that will be remembered and celebrated. The names of the dead will adorn the hero's mount on Steadfast. It is a deed worthy of your mother's memory, wouldn't you say?
Rain's hand actually twitches this time with the need to kill him, with the want to go for that saber. Serek smiles again. Behind him, the Castellan's power fists twitch too in response. It must be slaved in more ways than just by commands. She has no threat left to offer, but that of words.
When I was first assigned to the Rifles, I thought them desperate to burn, Rain says. They believed so strongly in the fates given to them that they seemed fatalistic, almost foolish.
She looks to the Antari officers now, in their plain greys, with honest reverence on their faces, with their scars and their beliefs worn plainly on their skin.
I underestimated them, she says. I have broken the unbreakable with them, toppled bastions and tyrants, burned cities and bled traitors. I thought at first that they were entirely other, but they are not. Not in the ways that matter. Not in the way of our hearts.
She closes her hand into a fist over her heart.
Because we are fierce and loyal.
She looks back to Serek.
And never to be underestimated.
The Lord General Militant laughs then. The sound sends cold fury through Rain's core.
Good words, Severina Rain, he says. Very good words.
And then he turns and walks away from her, disappearing back into the baying crowd. Gloam, before. When Severina arrives back at her dormitory, there is something amiss. A box sitting on her low, flat cot. It is unmarked, save for the scuffing of transit and the prints of dirty fingers.
Where did this come from? Severina asks.
It was here before me,
Ilaria says. She is sitting cross-legged on her own cot, reading from a sheaf of prayer papers. She doesn't look up from them.
Has anyone touched it? Severina asks.
Now Ilaria looks up. She has a scowl on her face like always. It accentuates her scars.
Why would they? She asks. It is addressed to you? More special treatment, I expect, for the last of Thema Rain's precious daughters.
Severina has fought Ilaria many times, in training and outside of it. But on this day, after visiting the punishment cell and seeing the traitor that she once called her sister, she does not fight. She does not raise her voice or lose her temper. She just stares at Ilaria instead, with her heart aching.
Get out, she says coldly. Now.
There is an instant of unease in Ilaria's face. She rolls up the prayer papers and slides off her cot.
I will get more peace in the chapel anyway, she says.
She leaves quickly without looking back. The wooden door shuts heavily behind her. Severina barely hears it, because all of her attention is devoted to the box. She crosses to the cot and sits down beside the box, takes a breath. Then she picks it up and puts it on her lap. It is not very heavy, not enough to contain weapons. Something slides around inside it when she tilts it, gently. She should take it to the abbots. Progena are supposed to give up their personal effects. They are given everything they need by the Skolem. Uniform, training, weapons. A home, when nothing else is left to them. She should take it to the abbots. But she doesn't. Instead, Severina breaks the seals on the box and lifts the lid. And then her heart truly does ache. Inside the box is a book titled The Many and Gloried Astra Militarum Regiments of the Bale Stars. It is worn and foxed, with cracks in its leather face. The foiled letters have worn smooth. Severina takes the book out with care and moves the box aside. The smell of the book is the smell of old parchment and candle smoke, of nights spent reading, long past when she should have been sleeping, of playing word games with Lucia. Something drops onto the leather cover of the book and runs into the cracks. Severina puts her hand to her face and brushes away a tear. She is so angry, so sad, so worn and damaged, just like the book. She takes hold of the leather cover of the book and runs her hand down the face of it. Then she hooks her fingers beneath it and pulls until the cover buckles, until the spine breaks and the binding comes unbound. Then she tears the pages out in handfuls and lets them fall to the ground around her like snow, like spent shells. She tears and tears until there is nothing left to break, and then she sits there, breathing and aching and trying not to cry again. And that is when she hears it, the ticking, soft and regular like a heartbeat, coming from the box beside her. She turns and looks into the box. The timepiece is settled into a corner, like a frightened thing, the brass casing catching the lumen light. Severina puts her hand into the box and takes hold of the timepiece. She looks at the bone and glass of its face, the beautiful brass casing and chain. She thinks of all the times she woke before Lucia to see her gripping the timepiece tightly, even in her sleep, the chain looped between her fingers like a noose. Severina turns it over. The back of the case is plain and unmarked. She takes a training knife from her belt and holds the timepiece steady as she pushes the point of it into the brass. She does it slowly and jaggedly, slipping once and nicking her hand. One letter at a time, she carves Lucia's name into the brass. When it is done, her hands are bloody, and so is the timepiece. It stings, all of it. Severina gets to her feet and goes over to the window. It is a narrow opening in the wall, like an arrow slit. The wind howls through unimpeded, carrying tiny flakes of snow with it. Severina holds the timepiece out of the window. It spins by the chain. Below, the hungry ocean roars, waiting for her to drop it, to let go. Under the sound of the wind and the ocean, Severina hears that ticking, regular, like a heartbeat. She wills her arm to move and her hand to open. She wills herself to hurl the timepiece into the ocean and her memories with it, to be unbreakable. But she can't. A pained noise escapes her, and Severina draws her arm back inside. She sinks to her knees and drives her closed fists into the floor until they are bloody too, until there's a breaking in her fingers, and in the face of the timepiece she is still holding. That is when she stops. When the glass goes, a tiny crack in the top of the face. Broken, like she is. Severina stays like that a while, long enough for the cuts to slow their bleeding, and for snow to gather on her clothes and in her tangled hair. Then she slowly lifts her head and puts the timepiece into the pocket in the chest of her tunic, the one close to her heart. Chapter 19. A Jagged Peak to Conquer. Rain stands in the Strategium, aboard the battlecruiser Wrath Unending, and looks upon the Laxian shipyards, the jagged peak that they have been tasked with conquering, the legend waiting to be written, the battle that is intended to be her last. The schematic is rendered in ink on parchment in excruciating detail, and is so large that it lays over the massive Strategium table like a shroud. Recent picked captures lie scattered on top of the parchment, taken by the fleet sent to the shipyards before this one. Those who failed. "Your objective is the Command Corps," Junikeen says. The Antari general is standing on the opposite side of the table from Rain, with three of her captains, Hale, Devry, and Sun. It feels strange to Rain to attend a briefing with only three, and not four, without Andren Fell. Keen leans forward and points to the command core. It is a spherical chamber connected by two bulkheads to the outer core, a ring of adamantium and void-safe armor glass that is linked to the shipyard's multi-layered docks and berths and build basilica by void-sealed gantries. Looked at in abstract, the shipyards are insectile, a central body surrounded by many jagged, jointed legs. On the schematic, the command core looks small, but going by the scale indicator on the schematic, that chamber alone is the size of the Strategium Hall on the Bale's Heart. Taken as a whole, the shipyards are bigger than the forges on Laxus Secundus were.
"Where are we to land, sir?"
Hale asks. Hale is out of his dress greys now, and back in his fatigues where he is comfortable. He leans on the edge of the table, taking in the schematic's details.
"Not at the core, I bet,"
Devry says with a grin,
"or this would hardly be worthy of a legend."
Keen smiles thinly. "Not at the core," she says. "Each company will land at a different location on the shipyard's voidwood side." She has to move a short way down the table and the schematic to point them out. "Blue will hit the upper docks," she says. "Gold, the repair berths beneath." Keen leans a little further to indicate a massive chamber on one of the shipyard's docks. "Grey, into Build Basilica Delphi." Keen picks up a handful of the scattered picks from the table. "The last fleet to hit the shipyards was Combined Navy and Astra Militarum," Keen says. "Two full companies of Paxar Soldiery and Tempestus Support."
"And what happened to them?"
Devry asks. She hands the picks around. The one that she passes to Rain is blurred and monochromatic, but it still sets her on edge. She hears Curran's son mutter an Antari curse under his breath.
"The sighted turned the shipyards against them,"
Rain says, looking at the hundreds of frozen floating dead in the pict.
"Sent them into the void."
Keen nods. "The Magos, Axon foe, is in control of the shipyard systems. Connected to them. That is only possible from the command core, even for one of the nine."
"So it will see where we are, and what we are trying to do?"
Hale asks. "Yes," Keen says, "but there is an advantage in the Magos' connection to the shipyards." She traces one of the finely inked lines on the schematic with her finger. It leads from the command core to a location in the shipyard's upper reaches, not far from Blue Company's landing zone. "Axon Foe is connected to all of the systems. For all intents and purposes, it and the shipyard are one and the same." Devry rubs at his unshaven jaw, thinking.
"So we hurt the shipyards, and we hurt the Magos,"
he says. "Precisely," Keen says. "That's your aim, and Sun's. Blue will go for the spinal auguries and blind it. Gold will destroy the auxiliary power nodes and starve it."
"And Grey?"
Hale asks. "Yours is the kill, Captain," Keen says. Yuri Hale smiles then. It pulls at the scars on his face.
"Aye, sir,"
he says. Curran's son puts down his pick and looks at Keen.
"I have a question, General,"
he says. Keen glances at him and folds her arms across her broad chest. "If it is about destroying the shipyards, then don't ask it. This is capture and control. We preserve as much of the facility as we can." Sun shakes his head and goes back to frowning at the schematic.
"Fine,"
he says.
"Then I do not have a question."
Devry claps Sun gently on the shoulder.
"One day," he says.
A smile breaks the thunder of Sun's face then, just for a moment.
"So how do we get close enough to kill the Magos?"
Hale asks. "The flotilla will exit the warp as close to the shipyards as they can, at the outer limits of the system's Mandeville point. They will push through the long-range defences, drop you at your landing zones, and then proceed to target non-critical areas on the opposite side of the shipyards from you in an effort to draw the Magos's eye.
Nothing like running under fire, sir,
Devry says, and he grins. You will need to run, too, Keen says. The flotilla will only be able to maintain position for so long before they have to retreat. Command can ill afford to lose the ships.
But they can afford to lose the Antari, Rain thinks, for the sake of Serek's lie.
She has to put down the Pict before she creases it in her hands.
How long do we have?
She asks. 6 hours, Keen says, at most. Devry gives a low whistle. He's not quite grinning now.
It will be enough,
Rain says, firmly. She needs them to believe it, because belief is what will get them through this fight and the one to follow. To lose this battle would not just be to lose the shipyards. It would be to lose the Bale Stars altogether.
This legend is ours to write, Rain says. We will not fail in that. We will fight fiercely and we will endure. In the Emperor's name.
All four of the officers echo those last four words together, with their closed fists held over their hearts. Warp exit is in 2 hours, Keen says. See to your companies and make good your oaths. The Laxian shipyards are the gateway to the western arm of the sector. Victory here changes everything. Rain looks down at the vast shape of the Laxian shipyards again, a reckoning written in black ink.
Yes, General, she says. It will.
Chapter 20. A Legend Waiting to be Written. The void unfolds to the viewscreen in front of Taran Vadri like a painted backdrop, like a flag being shaken out and made to fly. The pressure that comes with warp travel fades, the nausea recedes like the tide going out, and Vadri sees the Laxian shipyards, a massive jagged star of iron and steel set against the real stars. They dropped from the warp as close as they could, as close as they dared to. Beyond the shipyards, Lax's primary is a dull grey orb. Orbital defences hang in the planet's orbit, glittering like bright stones.
Status, Orgamaster!
The voice belongs to the shipmaster. Kasumi Sho never seems to need a moment to recover from translation. Vadri has heard her say that she relishes the jolt of it, and he can believe it. Sho relishes everything. Gambling, debate, drinking, but especially battle.
Translation successful, Vadri says, as data tracks down one side of his vision, fed straight into the lens that replaces his left eye. Just waiting for the others to catch up, sir.
She laughs loudly, like she always does. She is standing, because no Navy officers born of Paxar have command thrones, just a pulpit to shout from. Sho's regalia of green and gold is bright under the bridge lumens.
And we once again prove the value of our name, she says. Far Runner!
Everyone on the bridge knows how to answer, Vadri included. It is a reaction, like blinking.
Far Runner!
He shouts with the others, as the other ships in the flotilla tear their way from the warp and join them in real space. Their sister ship, the Sword Class Equinox, the Gothic Class Blade of Chorus, and lastly, the Wrath Unending. The Grand Cruiser is a bullish slab of old wounds and armor plating, scored and scarred from hundreds of years of being at the heart of a fight. Vadri has never in all his years of service seen a more beautiful ship.
Flotilla translation complete. Positioning within tolerances.
Data flares red in the false lens of Vadri's eye. Long-range auger chimes ring.
And we appear to have drawn the station's ire.
At first, it is just the station's long-range automated defences, lance fire that splashes across the shields as escorts move into position to protect the larger ships.
That's quite enough of that,
Sho says.
Put out their eyes, please, Dax.
Aye,
the gunnery officer replies.
Forward lancers firing.
Forward lancers,
slur the gunnery servitors in unison. They fire a split second before the Equinox does, collapsing the long-range defence systems as they push towards the iron tangle of the shipyards in formation. It feels close to Vadri, as if he could reach out and touch the Wrath, or the blade. But in reality, they are hundreds of kilometres apart. As the flotilla breaches the outer defence lines, Vadri's augurs start to sing again.
"Enemy movement," he says. "They are launching escorts. Two Cobras on an intercept heading."
She laughs.
"Two Cobras," she says. "I thought this was a shipyard. I thought this was a legend waiting to be written. Give me an intercept course and shunt power to the forward lancers. We will soften them for the Wrath."
The bridge is noisy with acknowledgements and relayed orders, with vox chatter from the attack squadrons preparing to launch. Vadri feels the far runner thrum in his bones as they enter the outer range of the Cobra-class destroyers. The shields flicker. Lance fire lights the void. Vadri sees it and he acknowledges it, but he does not focus on it, because he is trying to understand the augur readings and the data that is tracking across his vision. He frowns.
"More movement, shipmaster," he says.
The bridge shakes and the lumens gutter. Sho curses emphatically in her own tongue, just like the Wrath unending. It's a beautiful thing.
"If you can't tell me what it is, Taryn, then I don't know what you're sitting there for," she says. "Dax, get me a firing solution on those Cobras before they slip by us."
There's an eye from the gunnery officer. The attack squadrons have launched now too and are engaging with the enemy's own. They are tiny specks in the starlight. Vadri half sees one of the enemy Cobras light and list as Dax's lancers punch through her shields. She vents air and debris into the void like blood into water. Their sister is baring her teeth at the other Cobra. But Vadri sees what is beyond them too now, and he wants to curse like Sho.
"Shipmaster," he says, feeling warp tense all over again. "The movement is a battleship."
Vadri takes a breath. He can see it now. Massive, even at distance. A gloried skeleton, with some of her bones still open to the void. Old and angry and made for the kill.
"Apocalypse class," he shouts. "It's the Starforge sword."
Vadri knows the sword. Every Navy soul does. She was one of the most honored battleships of the Baelstars fleet before her near destruction at the Chorus Belt, before her relocation to Laxus for refit and repair. And now the damned sighted have her. Vadri feels a tear trace from his remaining unaugmented eye as the augurs ring louder in his head, deafening.
"She is preparing to fire,"
Vadri yells.
"Nova cannon!"
Sho cries an order from her pulpit that Vadri only hears half of over the impact alarms. Something about forward shields. It's not enough. Nothing they can do is. Not against a Nova cannon. Vadri makes sure not to blink as the fire comes for them. Because that internal fire, like the Wrath unending and Sho's violent cursing, is beautiful. Toka sees the Far Runner and the Equinox go in an instant through the armor glass of his cockpit. The explosion shakes his Fury Interceptor around him and puts her into a roll, shakes through his body and makes him bite his tongue. Even with the glare visor in his helmet dipping, it still momentarily blinds him. A good number of the other fighters are caught in it and vaporized in an instant. Dark shadows against the white.
"Emperor's mercy," he says between breaths.
Toka has time for nothing else, because the battle won't wait for grief. He puts the Fury into a steep spiral climb to get clear of the spreading debris and to try to shake the traitor interceptor still hanging on his tail. Ahead of them, the star